Hello, it's Friday the 22nd of October and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. Prime Minister Kim Buk-yeom has suggested that businesses hit hard by the pandemic will be given priority when it comes to easing quarantine restrictions as the nation draws up plans to transition to living with COVID. We'll have more details at the top of the show shortly. South Korea is set to announce next week temporary cuts to the fuel tax after soaring global oil prices have pushed up local fuel prices. We'll take a look at the government's plan for weekly economy review. And for Movie Spotlight, our critics will give their wrap-up of the Busan International Film Festival, as well as review the highly anticipated sci-fi epic Dune. Let's begin Korea 24. South Korea is now very close to achieving its goal of fully vaccinating 70% of its population, a milestone it needs to pass to transition into a normalizing system of living with COVID. To discuss this, as well as our other headlines of the day, we're joined in the studio by KBS World Radio news editor Eunice Kim. Hello, Eunice.
Hello, Jang-woo.
So we could hit that 70% goal this weekend. I understand that the Prime Minister made some comments about the coming transition today.
Yeah, Prime Minister Kim Buk-yeom, of course, is one of the heads of that joint committee on drafting a roadmap for that transition. He said on Friday he believes the country is slowly getting to the starting line for a return to normalcy. He also said that more than 70% of the population is projected to be fully vaccinated by as early as Saturday, and that the number of daily COVID-19 cases has seen a clear drop lately. First priority will be placed on facilitating businesses hit hard by the tight quarantine rules under the new system, as well as those who have been socially isolated and facilities that also have a low risk of infection. The Prime Minister was quick to add, though, that there would be no rush to return to normalcy, citing cases abroad that show transitioning into this living with COVID-19 system is an extremely challenging task that requires thorough preparation. Meanwhile, the committee has been deliberating various ideas on this transition, and what we know is that social distancing rules will be eased in phases starting in November, and basic quarantine rules will remain, such as wearing masks. It is considering lifting operation restrictions on restaurants, coffee shops, and other businesses, while adopting a vaccination and PCR test verification requirement for high-risk facilities. We'll know more, though, next Friday. That is when they are set to unroll the finalized details after a public hearing on Monday.
On a related note, Halloween is just around the corner, and health authorities have announced they will conduct a special sweep of adult entertainment establishments in areas densely populated by foreigners ahead of October 31st.
Right. The Central Disaster and Safety Countermeasures Headquarters on Friday said that inspection of neighborhoods in Seoul, such as Itaewon, Hongdae, and Gangnam Station, frequented by young people and foreigners alike, will begin on Wednesday and run through November 2nd. They will be done in conjunction with the Ministry of Food and Drug Safety, National Police Agency, and local governments, and the special teams plan to focus on ensuring that gathering restrictions, mask wearing, and other quarantine rules are being followed. Stern action is being warned for those who are found to breach the regulations, such as criminal complaints or a shutdown order for businesses, and deportation for foreigners found to have violated the rules.
Meanwhile, how did we do in terms of daily COVID-19 cases today?
Yeah, we remained in the 1400s for a second day. The KDCA said 1,440 new infections were logged throughout Thursday. That is a drop of more than 240 cases from a week earlier. Of the new cases, 20 were from overseas, and the capital region accounted for 80.6% of the domestic transmissions. 16 more deaths were reported, and the fatality rate stands at 0.78%.
Moving on to other headlines now, prosecutors have indicted a key figure in a high-profile land development corruption scandal. So what's the latest on this?
Yeah, a probe team at the Seoul Central District Prosecutor's Office on Thursday indicted Yoo Dong-kyu. He is, of course, the former acting president of Seongnam Development Corporation for receiving bribes. This marks the first indictment on the scandal that sparked this investigation late last month. Yoo is accused of receiving 352 million won from local developers in 2013 to develop the Daejangdong area in Seongnam, south of Seoul, and was allegedly promised to receive 70 billion won in kickbacks for offering favors for Hwachondaeyu Asset Management.
Turning to the presidential primaries next, Yoon Sung-yeol, one of the leading candidates in the main opposition People Power Party, continues to get slammed for controversial remarks he made on Tuesday, apparently in support of the authoritarian president Chun Doo-hwan. And this time it came from the Democratic Party's candidate.
That's right. Gyeonggi Governor Lee Jae-myung, who made a stop at the May 18th National Cemetery in Gwangju, South Jeolla Province, as his first official campaign event since being named the ruling Democratic Party's presidential candidate, is that person. This is, of course, the site of burial for many who died in the Gwangju pro-democracy movement. Lee Jae-myung said he was not surprised by Yoon's apparently advocating remarks that there are those who think Chun was a mostly successful politician despite the coup and his crackdown on the Gwangju pro-democracy movement. Lee cited Yoon's childhood of privilege keeping him from any understanding of the severe response that the name Chun Doo conjures up, and claimed that Yoon made no contribution to the nation's fight for democracy, human rights, and peace. He also said that if he becomes president, he would make sure that laws are revised so that crimes committed against the state by quote-unquote mass murderers like Chun have no statute of limitations for a full reckoning. Lee Jae-myung, meanwhile, is set to resign on Monday from his gubernatorial post after fulfilling his final duties for the last day that day.
Right, so Yoon did apologize for his remarks about President Chun on Thursday, yesterday, but this doesn't end here. Many were left scratching their heads after a post on Instagram appeared to make light of his own apology earlier.
Yeah, Yoon Sung-yeol had expressed his regret, as you said yesterday, for inciting anger. But earlier today, there appeared a picture on his pet dog Tori's Instagram, and it showed it as well as a yellow apple, to which the caption reads, "Hey Tori, it's a Indo sagwa, or an Indo apple." Now, given that the Korean word for apple and apology sound the same, many are asking whether these now deleted posts, including one from last night, are meant to make light of Yoon's earlier apology, and some even going as far as to say, does Yoon think the citizens are dogs? This left even PPP leader Lee Jun-suk perplexed, and fellow PPP presidential contender Hong Jun-pyo accused Yoon of deriding the public and party members. Yoon Sung-yeol is in fact participating in a debate tonight for the primaries of the PPP, and he apologized for the post. Earlier, his camp had taken the blame for it.
Let's look ahead to next week now. President Moon Jae-in is set to depart on a 9-day European tour as a part of plans to participate in the COP26 UN Climate Change Conference.
Indeed, and we heard from the presidential spokesperson Park Kyung-mi saying that President Moon will embark on the 9-day three-nation trip next Thursday and will be abroad through November 5th. It will also take him to, in addition to Glasgow, Italy and Budapest, Hungary. We also learned that on the itinerary is a second meeting with Pope Francis at the Vatican next Friday during his Rome visit for the G20 Leaders Summit. He will make an official trip to the Holy See to meet the pontiff as well as the Vatican Secretary of State, likely his last as head of state after his first visit in October of 2018.
And finally, despite South Korea's only partial success to launch a fully homegrown space rocket into space, they are continuing to go ahead with another launch next May.
Yeah, that's right. According to the Ministry of Science and ICT, as well as the Korea Aerospace Research Institute, the main objective of the launch will be to place a 1.3-ton dummy satellite and 0.2-ton performance verification satellite into a low orbit of between 600 to 800 kilometers above Earth. And the next launch date is tentatively set for May 19th. And if those goals are met, the government will launch Nuri 4 additional times, including those in 2024, 2026, and 2027, including loading a next-generation miniaturized satellite onto the Nuri. Ultimately, the goal here is to load a lunar probe on Nuri by the year 2030 and launch it into space. So, Changho, this is just the beginning.
We'll leave it there for our news briefing. Thank you for those updates.
You bet.
It's time now for Weekly Economy Review, our Friday in-depth segment covering some of the key economic issues of the week. Today, we'll be talking about South Korea's plan to temporarily cut fuel taxes amid surging international oil prices. We'll also discuss the possibility of South Korea joining the CPTPP trade agreement after Seoul delayed announcing their decision to early next month. Joining us now to zoom in on these issues, as usual, is economics professor Yang Jun-suk from the Catholic University of Korea. Professor, hello. I hope you had a good week.
I had a great week. Thank you very much.
So we start, as we always do for our review, with an update on the stock markets this week. How did the KOSPI and KOSDAQ fare, Professor?
Okay, well, for the KOSPI, it was mostly down this week, except for one big rise on Tuesday. But for the entire week, it wasn't a very good one. It closed today at 3,006.16, and for the week, it fell by 0.3%. For the KOSDAQ, it was up on Monday and Tuesday, but all that was undone on Wednesday and Thursday. It was slightly up on today, but still, it didn't do too well. It closed today at 995.16, and for the week, it fell by 0.46%. For the U.S. dollar versus Korean won, there was a large appreciation of the Korean won on Tuesday, and then slight depreciations since then. It ended today at 1,176.20. For the week, it appreciated by 0.49%.
Okay, let's move on to our main headline this week. South Korea has said that they plan to temporarily lower fuel taxes to ease consumer burden amid rising international crude prices. Now, the details, including the timing and the scope, will be announced next week. But Finance Minister Hong Nam-ki noted during a parliamentary audit on Wednesday that international prices have risen to the highest level since October 2018, and it seems unlikely that the prices will go down anytime soon. He added that such a rise is driving up domestic gasoline prices, which could have an impact on the real economy. So first, Professor, why are global oil prices soaring, and do you think a fuel tax cut is necessary?
Okay, well, the global oil prices hasn't been this high since 2014. Now, the Korean oil prices, gasoline prices have been especially rising very quickly, which is the biggest concern for the government. But the reason for international oil price increase, well, there's frankly a lot of them. And they're all hitting at the same time, which is why it's rising so quickly. So first, and probably the most important, is the increasing demand as world starts getting out of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's led by the United States, but all the other countries, their demand is rising also. And then second, OPEC and other oil producers had an agreement not to increase production. So that's making the price rise even further. And then third, there's supply bottlenecks in certain countries. There's problems in production because of countries which are not fully over COVID-19 pandemic yet because their vaccinations have not been proceeding very well. And there's transportation problems, especially with marine transportation. Fourth, there's a rise in price of natural gas. It's led by Russia, which is limiting exports to European countries. And because they need natural gas for electricity and for heating, that's causing an increase in prices, not only with the natural gas, but also with its close substitute, oil. Then fifth, there's speculation because of all these factors. There's a lot of excess liquidity, so they're putting their money in some speculative products in oil. Mm. And then sixth, the meteorologists are saying that it's going to be an extremely cold winter this year. So there's going to be even more demand for oil and other heating fuels. And then lastly, there's no competition from U.S. shale oil. Now, in the past, the OPEC countries, oil producers, tried to limit how much the price rises, because if the price rises too quickly and too much, the U.S. shale oil prices producers will come in. But this year, shale oil producers seem to be reluctant to increase their production. They would rather use the money that they're making to pay down the debt rather than explore new fields and increase production. So they're not as worried about competition from shale oil. So that seems to be keeping the prices up as well. And the World Bank expects oil prices to continue to rise until about second quarter next year. Oil price inflation feels worse because of the very large price fall in oil that we had last year. If we compare the oil prices before the coronavirus, it was about $63 per barrel in January of 2020. This fell to about $17 in April 2020. Then it climbed back up. Now it's around $84 per barrel. If it rose from $63 to $84, it probably wouldn't seem that bad. Mm. But it climbed up from $17 to $84, so it really seems to be alarming. And as you said, this rapid rise in oil prices have fueled political discussions on temporary fuel tax cuts for Korea. Well, do we need this temporary fuel cuts, temporary tax cuts, temporary fall in prices? Well, as an economist, I don't think it's ever good to artificially change prices. Mm. But on the other hand, Korea, we have a lot of taxes on fuel. Mm. So it's not completely changing the marketplaces, but still, you have to be a little bit nervous when government says they'll change prices due to political pressure. Having said that, there's some reason to be worried about the tax cut. Why would we want to temporarily raise demand for oil due to lower prices? Mm. And these type of tax cuts on oil usually benefits the richer part of the population rather than the poorer part, because the richer part of the population usually drives. But still, because of the current concern for inflation, there's probably some political justification for lower temporary reduction in taxes, especially for heating oil rather than gasoline.
Right. Wow. So a whole host of issues all contributing to this issue, and the government now here in South Korea considering this fuel tax cut. But this isn't the first time that South Korea has done this. Between November 2018 and May 2019, the government temporarily slashed fuel taxes then 15% for 6 months, again due to a spike in international oil prices. That cut was later reduced to 7% for an additional 4 months. Now, currently, according to OpenNet, an oil price information website run by the Korean National Oil Corporation, the average gasoline price nationwide surpassed 1,701 per litre, which is about $1.4. So how much of a cut would be appropriate, at least in your opinion, if we do go ahead with this cut, Professor? And what did we see last time?
Okay, well, about 40% of retail oil prices tax, and 50% for gasoline, it's about tax. And that's among highest percentage of tax per liter in the world. It's composed of value-added taxes, which are put on all goods, not just oil and gasoline. And in addition, oil tax, which is in turn composed of transportation tax, road usage tax, and education tax. Now, by law, oil tax can be reduced by 30% through executive order, but there's already a 10 to 11% cut in place, depending on what type of oil you buy. So government is weighing 15% additional cut. Remember, they cannot go beyond 30%. And if there is a 15% cut like there was in 2018 and 2019, that would be about 122 won. So it's not going to affect the average price, I think, too much, especially if you're in a metropolitan area where they're charging higher than average prices. Mm. But even more concerning is that that's about 6.7% cut from the current price. But there's a good possibility that the global oil prices will rise more than 6.7% before it's over. Mm. So it'll only mean a temporary reprieve.
Right, so Korean drivers might be able to enjoy some easing of prices soon, but how long that will last will be a longer-term question. Meanwhile, there was another decision that Seoul was mulling over this week. South Korea said it would announce a decision as early as next Monday on whether or not to join the trade pact called the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, or simply the CPTPP for short. But now they have decided to delay making that decision until early November. The trade pact consists of 11 countries, including Australia, Japan and Mexico. But last month, China and Taiwan applied to join the pact as well. So first, can you briefly explain for us what the CPTPP is and why South Korea would want to join?
Okay, well, CPTPP was originally formed to sort of combat the Chinese influence in the Asian Pacific area. It was led by the United States along with 11 other countries, including the ones that you mentioned. And while it was originally designed to combat Chinese influence in the area, U.S., when President Trump was elected, dropped out of the TPP, and the other 11 countries decided to go ahead, and they changed the name a little bit to CPTPP. Now it covers about 13% of global GDP and 15% of global trade, but that mostly comes from Japan. Now, Korea had been offered to join the TPP from the negotiating stage, but because Korea has FTA with all members of CPTPP except Mexico and Japan back then, Korea was a bit reluctant to join, so the TPP went ahead without Korea. Now Korea does have not a direct bilateral FTA with Japan, but through the RCEP, regional FTA, it does have a trading FTA with Japan, where Korea has opened about 83% of goods for trade. Mm. So because Korea has a very has FTA with almost all of these countries, any market opening effects are thought to be pretty marginal. Mm. And then some people are worried that this CPTPP, because the largest player is Japan, that Korea would actually lose by joining this FTA because, well, Korea is running a trade deficit with Japan mostly. So it may worsen the current trade deficit with Japan. And then the CPTPP has what's called a cumulative rules of origin, where Korea, if you're talking about bilateral FTAs with just one or one other country or a few other countries, Korea can act as a hub. Mm. But in CPTPP, Korea will be one country in a region. Hmm. So there's some theoretical argument on whether Korea would gain a lot from CPTPP, which was why it was very reluctant to join. And it faced a lot of reluctance and opposition by agricultural sector in Korea. But recently, Korea has trying to be rethinking about joining the CPTPP, partly because United Kingdom formally applied to join CPTPP because of their Brexit policies. Mm. They promised to join a lot of FTAs. And China has applied to join CPTPP as well, probably for diplomatic reasons and trying to upset the United States. And then as soon as China signaled interest, so did Taiwan, because Taiwan cannot join these international organizations by themselves. Mm. So it has increased Korea's attempts to join CPTPP. And according to some research by Korea Institute for Industrial Economics and Trade, if Korea joins the CPTPP, without United States, it would probably increase Korea's production by 0.4%. If U.S. joins as well, it'll increase Korea's production by 1.1%, but dairy and livestock sector, they'll lose about 13.9% of their production.
Right, but still it seems Seoul doesn't perhaps want to be left out. Very briefly, though, Seoul was meant to announce their decision next week, but they've been delayed until November now. Why do you think they've delayed that decision, and which way do you think the government will eventually decide?
Okay, it seems like they made this decision rather quickly, right after China said that they will join. So it's been about 1 or 2 months when they seriously started considering. And there's going to be a lot of reluctance, a lot of opposition by agricultural sector. And because it's the presidential election season, they don't want to deal with this political hot potato right now.
I see. So the decision for now is set to come in a couple of weeks, but we will see which way Seoul does indeed go. That'll leave it for our weekly economy review. Thank you for your analysis as always, Professor, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index fell 1.17 points, or 0.04%, on Friday, closing the week at 3,006.16. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ rose, however, gaining 1.37 points, or 0.14%, to close at 995.07. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 0.11 against the dollar, ending the day at 1,177.11. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
We continue on now to Korea Trending, our daily segment where we take a look at some of the other news stories that have been trending online in Korea today. And for that, joining us in the studio, we have Walter Lee, one of our contributors for this segment. Walter, hello. It's great to see you.
Hello, Jung. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. So what topics have you brought for us today?
Okay, so we first delve into South Korea's first instance of a home-treated COVID-19 patient dying in transit to the hospital. We'll then cover the impressive performance by the South Korean women's national soccer team when they faced off against the powerhouse that is the USA. And finally, we'll find out which South Korean actor has been nominated for a Gotham Award for his role in a breakout series.
Okay, so we start with a story about a COVID-19 patient who sadly died, but perhaps could have been saved had there not been some issues with the emergency transport. Can you tell us more?
Yes, so a COVID-19 patient who was being treated at home in accordance with quarantine guidelines died on the way to hospital, according to fire authorities. It turns out that it had taken over an hour to transport the patient. According to an exclusive report by the Dong-a Ilbo on Thursday, the 68-year-old patient's condition at Seodaemun District worsened drastically at around 6 a.m. that day. The patient's guardian called 119 at 6:51 and emergency medical technicians, or EMTs, arrived 19 minutes later. But the patient wasn't transported immediately to the hospital as the EMTs who arrived weren't properly equipped to transport a COVID-19 patient.
Okay, so if they weren't properly equipped, how was this resolved? How was the patient transported to the hospital in the end?
Well, the patient was eventually transported after another group of EMTs exclusively tasked with COVID-19 cases arrived at the patient's house. This group had failed to immediately make it to the patient's house because they had not finished the effort of wrapping the interior of the ambulance with special film intended to prevent infections. It was 7:30 a.m. when this group arrived and gave the patient first aid treatment, and it was a little past 8 a.m. when they made it to the hospital in Seoul's Jongno District. But the patient was pronounced dead at the hospital. This marks the first time in South Korea that a COVID-19 patient, being treated at their home has died in transit to the hospital.
Yes, so this is disconcerting news as the nation is bracing to return to normalcy in phases soon in a few weeks, and that involves more at-home treatments for COVID-19 patients experiencing mild or no symptoms.
That's correct, and that's why calls have emerged for the nation to promptly enhance the system for transporting COVID-19 patients being treated at home to hospitals. Some experts have expressed concerns about relying solely on EMTs for transporting such patients. As of the end of last year, the nation was estimated to have 1,558 ambulances, but only a few of them were found to be specifically equipped to transport COVID-19 patients, including having negative pressure systems.
Yes, there will understandably be criticism that it's taken the cost of someone's life to for health authorities to recognise and address this issue. Hopefully, we won't hear of such stories again, but it could make people nervous as we try to shift to the next stage of handling the pandemic in Korea. OK, let's continue on to our next story. What have you got for us next?
Right, so the South Korean women's national soccer team recorded an impressive scoreless draw against the US team, which ranks number one in the world. Led by manager Colin Bell, Team Korea ranked 18th when up against the powerhouse Americans in a friendly match held at the Children's Mercy Park in Kansas City of Kansas on Thursday. The draw was all the more significant as the US was on their 22nd match winning streak on home soil and just one win away from matching the longest home streak in team history. However, it's almost like history repeated itself because the last time the US failed to win at home on home turf was against South Korea in a one-all draw back in October 2019.
Right, so it looks like South Korea is maybe the bogey team for the US.
Right.
I understand it was the Taeguk ladies' tenacious defense that held strong against Team USA's attacks, but there was one particular player who stood out from the Korean team in Thursday's match, right?
That's right, and that would be the goalkeeper Yoon Young-gu. She guarded the net with all her might from US players' strong shots. She successfully blocked a mid-range shot that came from the left in the 24th minute, as well as a shot kicked by striker Carly Lloyd from the penalty box in the 31st minute in the second half. These are just a few of the key saves Yoon made against the American onslaught. And the US had 19 shots on goal compared to Korea's only 8.
Right, so it was a fairly one-sided affair, but that is, of course, expected when facing the world number one team. The two sides will be competing again in another friendly next week, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So it will be next Wednesday in St. Paul, Minnesota at 9 a.m. our time. These friendlies are being held as part of preparations for the 2022 Asian Football Confederation Women's Asian Cup, set to kick off in India in January.
Yes, definitely a good stern test for Korea in preparation for that. Hopefully, though, we'll see some goals on Wednesday, though. Okay, let's move on to our final trending story. What do you have for us?
Yes, so South Korean actor Lee Chung-jae has been nominated for Gotham Awards for his performance in Netflix hit series, obviously, Squid Game. The independent filmmaker project unveiled on Thursday its final list of nominations for the 31st annual Gotham Awards. Lee was included among 10 nominees in the category of Outstanding Performance in a New Series. The veteran actor will be competing against other actors such as Jennifer Coolidge, Michael Grey Eyes, and Ethan Hawke. Squid Game also earned a nod in the Breakthrough Series long format category.
Yes, this is exciting news, especially given that the Gotham Awards signal the kickoff to the Entertainment Awards season, meaning that there could be more nominations for E and Squid Game to come later.
You're correct. So organised by the Independent Filmmaker Project, the Gotham Awards is regarded to be one of the leading awards in independent film. Observers often make projections as to what the Film and Entertainment Awards season is going to look like that year with nominations and results from the Gotham Awards. Take note that in last year's Gotham Awards, Yoon Yeo-jung was nominated for Best Actress for her role in Minari.
Yes, so I'm sure fans will be watching to see if Lee can go on to emulate the success that Yoon had last year.
That's right. Don't forget that Yoon won the Best Supporting Actress at the Oscars earlier this year, making history by becoming the first South Korean to win an acting award at the Oscars. Now, though Lee's role wouldn't apply for the Oscars, as Squid Game is considered a series, top awards to look out include the 2022 Golden Globes to be held on January 9th, with nominations coming this December. Lee's fans will have to wait several weeks as the Gotham Awards will be held on November 29th. Unlike last year when the event was held online, this year's ceremony is set to be held in an in-person format at the event's longtime venue in Cipriani Wall Street in New York.
Yes, for fans of Korean film and TV, they will already know how fantastic an actor Lee has been for many years now, but it's still great to see him get such international recognition as well now. That's where we'll leave it for today's Korea Trending. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Walter, and we'll see you again next week.
See you next week.
Thank you. It's time now for our Friday feature, Movie Spotlight, reviewing the latest releases at the Korean box office and on streaming platforms. And we do that with our panel of film critics and experts in the studio with me today. First, we have Jason Beshevace. Hello, Jason.
Hello.
And we also have with us this week, Mark Raymond. Mark, it's great to see you again.
Nice to see you.
Now, Jason, the last time we spoke was a couple of weeks ago. We connected with you via phone from the Busan International Film Festival. At that point, the festival had only really just got going and you hadn't seen many films then, so it was more of a preview. But now that you have seen more of the films, I understand you were there too, Mark. So we thought this week we would do a quick roundup and review of the festival, especially as there are no major Korean releases this week. There is a major Hollywood release that we'll get to a bit later. But first, Jason, can you briefly remind us about Busan, about the significance of Busan as a festival for discovering Korean films in just a couple of sentences?
Yeah, sure, Jango. The growth of Busan as a festival has grown, I think, with the wider Korean film industry, both locally and internationally over the last two decades. Busan has this reputation now as the kind of Cannes of Asia, and it solidified its reputation in showcasing new young talent through its New Currents and Korean cinema sections, where each year there will be invariably a new discovery, and this year was no exception.
Okay, so Mark, can you kick us off then with the New Currents section, because this is the signature section of the festival's program where many discoveries are found each year.
Yeah, this is the section where theoretically you usually get the best Korean films, because it's a mixture of two or three Korean films with international competition kind of films. So that's not always the case. Sometimes the New Currents films aren't as great, but this year they certainly were. Mm. And we had two Korean films in the section, both of which I think both Jason and I would agree with were the best films, the Korean films at the festival. They were Park Kang's Seore and Kim Se-in's The Apartment with Two Women. Two very different films. Seore is a horror film, which is a little unusual at Busan. We don't get a lot of horror films, partly because it's usually these are independent films, lower budget. This film really makes the lower budget work, actually. And it's actually one of those films that you're almost glad it didn't have a bigger budget, because they might have actually kind of ruined the film by making it too special effects heavy or things like that. It makes it more, it's more like a 70s kind of horror film. I was reminded of like Rosemary's Baby and these kind of movies. And it's about a kind of this folk belief about that the baby's first 21 days, there should be... there has to be these kind of superstitions around, you know, for example, not going to a funeral and the husband ends
up... Not letting anyone in the house.
You know, not letting anyone in the house. And the husband breaks this rule because his ex-girlfriend has committed suicide and things go badly from there, as you can imagine. But it's a very effective piece, and it doesn't... And horror films are very difficult to land the ending, and this one really does. It never really... You're almost wondering... You know, it's great. It's easy to set up horror films and start to execute them. Mm. This one does both very well. And the other film, The Apartment with Two Women, it's much more of a drama. A little bit like a lot of Korean indies, where it's a woman in her 20s who's kind of struggling with in Korean society. But this one's different in that it's mostly about her relationship with her mother. Mm. And the mother character is a great performance and kind of one of these bad mother Hall of Fame kind of candidates, but also a but also a character who's pretty not sympathetic, is not the right word, but at least the movie isn't simply she's bad, the daughter's good. It's a much more complicated. It's almost like something you might see in like an Ingmar Bergman film, the two characters almost like merge together at certain points. And it's very well done, and the director is actually under 30 years old, so it's very exciting.
Yeah, she's born in 92. Yes. Wow. I mean, Yoon Dam-bi as well, moving. There was a fantastic debut a couple of years ago. She made Moving when she was under 30. So there's this just incredible wave of talent coming through right now. It's really, really inspiring.
So those are the two highlights from the New Current section. What about some of the films in the Korean Cinema Today program then, Jason?
Yeah. The films weren't as good as the new currents, as Mark mentioned. You know, new currents this year were absolutely fantastic. Two of some of the, I think, the great debuts over the last decade. In Panorama, Hong Jun-pyo's animation, Chanteol, Stay With Me. I won't mention any more about that because I did talk about it briefly a couple of weeks ago. Mm. We also have Park Lee-rung's The Girl on a Bulldozer, which actually I thought I quite liked. There's some issues with it. But the leading performance by Kim Hye-yoon is just fantastic. She was in Sky Castle as well. So I think we're going to see more from her as a major performer in the years ahead. In the vision section, my favourite so far, I'm still going through them, is Park Song-yeol's Hot in Day, Cold at Night. And there's also the Korean Academy of Film Arts film, Oh Sung-ho's Through My Midwinter, which I thought was quite good. A solid feature debut there.
So just to wrap up Busan this year then, after looking at this year's programme, Mark, what do you think it says about Korean cinema going forward?
Yeah, I think this was a pretty good year. I mean, obviously the two new currents films we mentioned, but also the vision films. Yeah, they weren't maybe as strong as in some previous years, but there were. I did quite like Through My Midwinter, which Jason mentioned. I think that's quite a solid film as well. And yeah, just this kind of festival, along with Jeonju as well. This is where we're getting these kind of more sort of these newer voices, and yep, it's where we're getting some diversity, like I mentioned, like with more female directors, more and more every year, and that's continued again this year, which is great.
Yeah. It's also worth mentioning about Seere, is that that film actually got funding and support. It won prizes at the Jeonju Film Festival, Bucheon Film Festival, and it premiered at, you know, premiered in Busan. So all three festivals played a part there. Mm-hmm. And also it's a project by the Korea University of Film Arts. And the other film, The Apartment with Two Women, is a CAFA film, the Korean Academy of Film Arts. So I think it's interesting. You've got festivals playing a part. You've got these Korean academies playing a part. And they're now financing features, not just short films. So that's giving these younger filmmakers a voice.
Right, so there's this collaborative spirit within Korean film industry, which is encouraging. I'm sure we'll be talking more about some of these titles when they get a commercial release sometime next year or so. But for now, we'll leave Busan there because there is quite a major and interesting international release this week. It's the long-awaited science fiction epic called Dune. So, Mark, can you set this one up for us?
Okay, I'll do my best. this is the second adaptation of Frank Herbert's 1965 sci-fi novel, which has this really loyal fan base. Mm.
It's very loyal.
Very loyal, yeah. And therefore, it's been considered a kind of a difficult, if not impossible, property to adapt. Mm. It was adapted in 1984 by the great David Lynch, and it was a kind of a financial and critical disaster, kind of a famous one. And this latest attempt comes from Denis Villeneuve, who is a fellow Canadian, so I'll shout that out. And, and he's a great filmmaker. I think he's made films like Sicario, Arrival, Blade Runner 2049. And this has a really incredible cast as well. Timothy Chalamet, Oscar Isaac, Javier Bardem, Rebecca Ferguson, many others. The plot is quite complicated, so I'm not going to go into too much detail. There's a lot of plot. But the basic premise is that There's this desert planet, and they have this precious resource that everyone in this empire wants. And the lead character, played by Chalamet, is kind of a prince of this family who's kind of taken over as the colonial overlords. And he's dealing with the natives who have kind of gone underground, and also with his own kind of visions of the future. So a friend of mine called it the Messiah during the oil crisis kind of storyline, which is a good kind of description, I think. It's worth noting this is only half of the original novel. The ads are kind of playing that down, but this is really part one of
part one of the beginning, doesn't it?
Mm. Yeah, but the advertisement. So we don't actually get the whole novel. He's just taken half of the novel, and I guess they're hoping they will make the second novel. And there's, of course, tons of sequels, tons of subsequent books, both by Herbert and then by Herbert's son as well.
So Jason, this novel, as we've noted, has a very big devoted fan base. It was also seen as a work that was almost impossible to adapt due to its size and scope, as hinted by Mark there. And the 84 David Lynch film almost seemed to prove that in a way as well.
Yeah.
So this film had to tackle all that, as well as appeal to the fans of the novel, but also make it approachable enough to draw in a big blockbuster-sized audience. How does it try to do this then?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting film. I liked it. I didn't think it was a masterpiece. I do like Denis Villeneuve. I think he's a terrific filmmaker. He doesn't write his scripts normally. He's certainly part of the process, but he's just a terrific visual filmmaker. Mm. I don't think it's up there with the best of his films. But I love the visuals. I wish I'd seen it on an IMAX screen. I just felt like I was watching it at home. You know, the sound design was absolutely fantastic. Visually extraordinary. I wasn't wild about Hans Zimmer's score, though. I think he set the bar so high for himself that, you know, he obviously got the Dark Knight films and his, you know, the Christopher Nolan collaborations. So I came out kind of, I mean, thinking, should I go and download the soundtrack and listen to it again? Because, like, for me, it was a big part of the film. Mm. But pacing-wise, I think the first hour is going to be a real hard sell for Korean audiences, to be honest with you. There is a lot going on, and there's not a lot going on, depending on, you know, your perspective. If you're a fan of the novel, certainly, and you're a fan of kind of layered and nuanced films, I think you'll love it. But for those who just want, you know, a lot of action, set pieces, there are some great sequences there, but I think there's just so much focus on this kind of the substance of the novel.
Right, setting up the story.
Yeah, but the second half of the film, it's certainly kind of gets going. But I liked it. I thought it was good. But I think if you are going to see, you want to see it on a big screen, I do recommend seeing it on a IMAX screen when you can, because I don't think it's going to be long before it's taken off.
Sure.
It's doing well internationally, though, the film.
So Jason liked it with reservations. What about you, Mark?
Yeah, about the same. The first hour, it's just it's really slow going. I admit I kind of dozed off a couple times, but as it picks up, it's quite good. The second half's quite good, and the cast is excellent, and even the action sequence, they have a bit of like some of the Marvel CGI problems at times, but overall I found they were strong, pretty strong action scenes, and it was a compelling story. Again, only really half the story, but where this film ends, it's a fairly logical point. It feels like a fairly contained story, and yeah, I'd recommend it, but yeah, it's probably one of Villeneuve's. It's not one of his greatest films, but it's pretty good.
Okay, so recommended, but with reservations from Mark as well. So that was Dune, out now in theatres. That's where we'll have to wrap it up. Mark, Jason, thank you both for being with us today, and it's been a pleasure as always.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. Take care.
We've now come to our Friday closing segment, next week from Seoul, where we take a look at what's going on in the week ahead. For that, we have our staff editor, Mark Wilson-Chair, joining us in the studio. Mark, hello. It's great to see you.
Happy Friday.
So what do you need to look out for next week?
Right. President Moon Jae-in will virtually participate in a series of summits next Tuesday and Wednesday, organized by the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN. The summits will discuss ways to step up cooperation to cope with public health crises such as COVID-19 and regional solidarity in a post-pandemic era. On Tuesday, Moon will hold an online group summit with the leaders of ASEAN to discuss cooperation in various fields, and will also hold a group summit with the representatives of the five Mekong River nations, Vietnam, Cambodia, Myanmar, Laos, and Thailand, to discuss ways to forge deeper ties. Now, on Wednesday, Moon will join the 24th ASEAN Plus 3 Summit. That's the dialogue involving the heads of ASEAN with South Korea, China, and Japan. And also on Wednesday, Moon is scheduled to attend the East Asian Summit. That is with the ASEAN Plus 3 members and the United States, Russia, Australia, India, and New Zealand.
Yeah, so it looks like President Moon will have a very busy week next week, because as we covered in our news briefing, he's also off to Europe from Thursday for the G20 Leaders Summit and COP26, as well as meeting the Pope at the Vatican. So full schedule ahead for the President. Okay, what else is set to happen next week, Mark?
South Korea will hold an annual nationwide defense exercise beginning next Monday. According to the Joint Chiefs of Staff officials on Friday, the annual military exercise named Hoguk will continue until November 5th, involving the ROK Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps. The Hoguk exercise, which began in 1996, is held during the latter half of the year, and its focus is on strengthening defense readiness and enhancing inter-service cooperation.
Right, so this is a Korean-only military exercise without U.S. troops, so it should mean less protests from North Korea, but we'll see how it goes. Right, time to cover just one more thing set to happen next week. What else do you have for us, Mark?
Just as you talked about the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or the FDA, authorizing booster shots of COVID-19 vaccines made by Moderna and Janssen yesterday, many probably asked themselves, how long is it going to take for South Korea to unveil its plan to greenlight these two boosters? Well, the answer is not very long, as South Korea's announcement on that, as well as cross-vaccination of those two boosters, could come out as soon as next week. An official of the Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency, or the KDCA, said at Thursday's COVID-19 briefing, that they're on it pretty much. That's after they further assess the FDA's decision, relevant research results, and overseas policy trends, in essence, just to see what everybody else is doing. This is all pretty timely, as President Moon urged on Monday for officials to swiftly draw up a booster vaccination plan for those who've been inoculated with the single-dose Janssen vaccine, which has been found to quickly lose its efficacy over time.
Right, only about 1.4 million people in Korea received the Janssen shot, which is about 4% of the population, mostly military-related personnel over the age of 30, and that was given out in June. So a fair significant chunk of the population and their six-month period for a booster is approaching now. We'll likely find out what the government plans next week, as you said. Well, that's all for next week from Seoul, Mark. Thank you for that roundup, and we'll see you next week.
Have a great weekend.
And that brings us to the end of Korea 24 this week. We'll be back on Monday, so do join us again then to continue to get your daily dose of news analysis from Korea. Till then, we hope you have a wonderful weekend. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you as always for listening. Goodbye.
KBS World Radio.